Duke's real genius was not really in the wedding of words and music, which is what a songwriter does, you know, a George Gershwin or an Irving Berlin. Duke was more like a Stravinsky or Bach or Mozart. He creates an entire universe for you.
His legacy is that he took American music, music that came directly from the African American tradition, and put it squarely in the center of who we are and what we're about as Americans. In doing that, I think he became one of the greatest composers of the 20th century.
Duke Ellington is the foremost jazz musician of our time, especially as a composer, arranger, and orchestrator. I do think that definitely he is the most dominating figure that jazz has ever had.
We're fortunate to have the legacy of Duke Ellington's brilliant music, we still lack the answers to an ongoing puzzle. How did he arrive at his complex, multi-layered, strikingly original compositions? I'm Nancy Wilson. In this special edition of Jazz Profiles, we'll learn how a genius composes on the second of two shows on Duke Ellington, the composer. Composers have written with the scope and breadth of Duke Ellington, and only a select group of intimates can discuss the process he used. Ellington's drummer, Louis Belson, recalls what it was like to live with the prolific writer.
I roomed with Duke, and I only lasted for a week because Ellington stayed up all night writing music. He wrote music every day, and my bedroom was right by the front door. So every 5 minutes, there would be a knock on the door. Flowers from Mr. Ellington, 5 minutes later, telegram from Mr. Ellington. So I didn't get any sleep at all. So I finally had to go to Duke and say, Duke, if you want a good, solid, strong drummer who's fresh, you better let me get some sleep.
Composer and conductor Gunther Schuller echoes Belson's experience.
After the last show, he would put on his gorgeous maroon silk robe and put his stocking cap on to keep his hair in place. And he would sit down at the piano and just ruminating at the piano, just improvising, just playing. Every once in a while, the playing would stop, and I could hear like the scratching of a pencil, you know, and he would write down the idea that he had just heard.
The songwriting business was full of imitators during the 1930s and 40s. Perhaps this was why Ellington had players memorize their parts, leaving little written music lying around for competitors to steal. Also, as a consummate showman, Ellington knew better than anyone that there was romance in the mystery of composing.
Ideas? Oh, man, I got a million dreams. That's all I do is dream all the time.
But when he dreamed, he always did so with a swinging beat. Trumpeter and band leader, Wynton Marsalis.
First, Duke liked the groove. So he would write the grooves out for his rhythm section. He would sing it to him. He was one of the first to really have the rhythm section extremely, very organized. They had different types of swing, like a tight swing, ting, 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 a loose swing, ting. Different ways of using the brushes. He understood our music from the ground up.
Ellington trumpeter, Clark Terry.
He has a very, very unusual rhythmic approach, you know. Different things that most people would not think of. And yet, it always swung. And as he said many, many years ago, which still holds true today, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Ellington's composing muse we do know about. It was his orchestra. He was writing for a group of individualistic talents, each one a master on his instrument. The challenge of composing for them inspired Ellington to produce at his highest level. Wynton Marsalis.
Well, he was inspired by them because the cats were there and they would be playing and he would hear things from them. But no matter who he had in the band, he would write something for them. So, yeah, they inspired him.
Frequently during rehearsal, Ellington heard someone playing a phrase that appealed to him. He would extract a nugget from the maze of sound, experiment, and sometimes develop it into a complete piece. He would also consider the final work his own. His players rarely objected. In fact, most were flattered. Clark Terry.
He would always allow the people in his entourage and his ensemble to give vent to their feelings and suggest things that the band should be doing. There's a number of tunes that the band played which he allowed individuals to insert little bits and pieces of their own personality. For instance, on the end of one tune, da-doo, 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 da-doo. I started doing that on one occasion. He said, yeah, keep that in, you know. And he was just beautiful like that. So he had an idea that he could use all these people, use all their ideas, and still, it would still be Ellington.
Often, an Ellington player would not receive a co-composing credit for his input, and some musicians took exception to this. Saxophonist Johnny Hodges openly told Ellington to stay out of the kitchen, which meant to stop using Hodges' ideas as song material. But cornetist Rex Stewart was satisfied as long as he was paid for his inspiration. Singer Joya Sherrill recalls the song she and Stewart co-composed.
I remember when I wrote Kissing Bug with Rex Stewart. Rex knew that I had written a couple of things, so he gets on the bus one day and he says, da 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 Kissing Bug, write that, he says to me. And so I did it. Let's show it to the man, he says. So we go into the dressing room between shows, and he says, I want you to hear this. So I sang the song for him. And Duke after I finished, she said, "When did I write that song?"
You say that I'm the one you love. You swear by every star above. And then you kiss some other mission. Nothing but a kissing bug. You promise that you'd take my hand and lead me to the preacher man. But now I find it's just a line. You're nothing but a kissing bug. You wouldn't, you couldn't be true if you tried. I'm gonna buy some bugaboo, and that will put an end to you.
Kissin' Bug, recorded April 26, 1945, featuring singer Joya Sherrill. I'm Nancy Wilson with a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on NPR's Jazz Profiles.
Kissin' Bug.
And now I'd like to introduce our writing and arranging companion, who we've been so much indebted to for contributing so many of the high spots of our performances. I'd like to, at this time, present Billy Strayhorn.
As a courtesy to a friend, Ellington auditioned a young pianist named Billy Strayhorn at Pittsburgh's Stanley Theater on December 1st, 1938. Stunned by the talent he heard, Ellington devised a plan to bring Strayhorn to New York and use him as a lyricist. Billy Strayhorn, in a radio interview from the early 1960s.
I was more or less forced by my friends to go and see him in Pittsburgh. I was a soda jerk, you know, and a delivery boy in a drugstore.
Had you written any lyrics at the time?
Yeah, I had.
That were successful, let's put it that way.
Well, they were unheard. They were just heard by the drugstore customers. And they got after me to have someone else hear them, you know. So he was the one.
One of the pieces he sang at the drugstore was a song that would forever be immortalized as a Strayhorn classic, Lush Life. The song wowed Ellington.
Now life is awful again. A truffle of hearts could only be a bore. A week in Paris will ease the bite of it. All I care is to smile in spite of it. Forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive.
But Strayhorn was also a schooled musician, and Ellington saw the potential here as well. Pianist and educator Billy Taylor believes that Strayhorn opened up new compositional possibilities to Ellington.
Ellington immediately grasped that Billy Strayhorn had information that he was going to be able to use. He was like a reference book. There were things that he knew about orchestration, things that he knew about composition, things that Billy Strayhorn knew about all of the things that Ellington was experimenting with. I mean, he was experimenting with long forms. Billy had played long forms in his classical studies, both as a pianist and as a composer who was studying composition.
While the orchestra toured Europe in 1939, Billy Strayhorn stayed at the Ellington home in New York. Ellington's friend and film producer, Gene Bach.
He said, now, this young man is coming on board. He's going to stay with us for a year, and he's going to study my methods and the Ellington arranging style and everything. And he said, and at the end of the year, we're going to have a very serious graduation ceremony. And, of course, the first year came and went. There was no graduation. He stayed with him till he died.
For nearly 30 years they worked together, Ellington toured widely, while Strayhorn remained in New York, writing new music for the orchestra.
Well, Strayhorn lives the life that I would love to live, you know. He is the pure artist.
Duke Ellington.
He writes when the spirit strikes him, and what he writes is pure Strayhorn.
And if Ellington was evasive about his composing methods, Billy Strayhorn, his young partner, was even more so.
Jazz composition? Oh, my. What do you want me to say? I don't usually talk about composition or about music. I prefer to write it.
Lotus Blossom, composed in 1946 by Billy Strayhorn. Soon after joining Ellington's organization, Strayhorn became his co-writer and arranger. With Ellington's support, he lived openly as a homosexual, a rare feat for a black man in America in the 1940s. While Strayhorn's expenses were covered, no formal contract between the two was ever drawn up. Duke Ellington's granddaughter, Mercedes, says it was a relationship based in mutual trust and mutual need.
If anybody ever in their own lives has come up across a soulmate, I think that's kind of the closest assessment of that type of a relationship that they had. This was somebody who thought the way he thought, who could hear the same sounds before they came out.
Billy Taylor.
One of the most misunderstood aspects of the Strayhorn-Ellington relationship is the fact that Duke really considered Billy Strayhorn his son. I mean, he treated him like a son and heir, much to the chagrin of Mercer, his real son. Yet they were so close, Ellington and Strayhorn, that musically, there didn't have to be very much conversation.
Jean Bach heard their symbiotic relationship in her own living room as they performed one of their trademark four-handed piano works, Tonk.
I have a recording that was made in my house on a truncated keyboard. I was living over in the West Village in a dump with a little crummy nightclub piano. And these two guys are sitting at the piano, Duke and Billy, and they're playing. And you have a hard time figuring where one gets through and the other one picks up.
Tonk, a four-handed piano piece, co-written by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn in 1940.
Strayhorn brought a European classical element that Ellington lacked, and with it, he enriched the orchestra's repertoire.
You can see the work of Billy Strayhorn and see his very important role in the corpus of the Ellington Band's recordings.
Ellington biographer John Edward Hesse.
You can get to the actual voicings that made that unique Ellington sound in a way that unlocks some of the mysteries of the Ellington effect and what you could even call the Strayhorn effect.
On January 1, 1941, ASCAP, the music licensing organization, banned all its composers from making records. Since Strayhorn and Ellington's son Mercer weren't ASCAP members, they were allowed to write for the orchestra, seamlessly duplicating the Ellington style. But it was the song which the young apprentice had composed earlier that would further propel Strayhorn's career.
Take the A-Train was the first orchestration of its kind to come into the world of orchestral jazz.
A-Train's detailed orchestration represented a refinement and new sophistication in jazz. Composer and arranger, Gerald Wilson.
And it happened to have been Billy Strayhorn's composition, arrangement, and orchestration. Because, you see, Take the A-Train was a milestone in orchestral jazz. So he had a way of being able to utilize the people that worked with him.
Recording of Take the A-Train was a tremendous hit and became the orchestra's opening theme. Its 32-measure AABA form is a classic orchestration, highlighted by call-and-response punctuation from the reed, trumpet, and trombone sections, and by Ray Nance's classic trumpet solo. Coming up, Duke Ellington's musical relationship with Billy Strayhorn deepens, and Ellington composes one of the most ambitious works ever in jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to the second of two shows exploring the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on Jazz Profiles from NPR National Public Radio.
Duke Ellington was already an important composer by the time he met Billy Strayhorn, but together they formed a writing team that has never been equaled in jazz. Trombonist and educator David Baker.
Even though they were contemporaries, I can't imagine Handel and Bach collaborating on a piece. And yet we're talking about two people of comparable stature when you say Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington. And to imagine that they were able to collaborate on pieces and have such wonderful results, even though they were two independently minded people.
In late 1942, at the urging of his new manager, William Morris, Ellington decided to make a bold statement and feature a formal presentation of a new and yet to be written extended composition. Ellington decided on a renowned world-class venue in which to present his first concert work. Carnegie Hall would host his ambitious Black, Brown, and Beige. Duke Ellington.
This was this big Carnegie Hall thing for the benefit of the Russian war relief, you know, to begin with on one hand. And the writing of Black, Brown, and Beige, of course, had tremendous social significance to begin with. It had a lot to say about the Negro in America, you know, as you know. And we tried to parallel their attitude and perspective along the line.
Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, a tone parallel to the history of the Negro in America, was a 44-minute orchestral suite in three movements. It premiered on January 23, 1943, before a celebrity-filled audience. The first movement, Black, is an extended tone poem which runs approximately 20 minutes and incorporates two themes. The first, Work Song, is driven by Harry Carney's baritone and by Sonny Greer's timpani drums. Ellington's trombonist, the Monsignor John Sanders.
It began with the Work Song, which was a theme to express that they're working out in the fields. It's a strong theme in Black, Brown, and Beige, and it's expressed, stated, and developed in that first movement.
Sunday, the second theme of Black, Brown, and Beige reaches a moving climax with a 32-bar alto saxophone chorus by Johnny Hodges.
Come Sunday, the second movement was the time, as the Duke described it, when they would rest. Come Sunday, we're out of the fields, it's a time to worship, to pray. And the piece expressed this longing and the desire to pray, to sing, and to ask God, someone who is mighty, to help them.
Thank you.
Come Sunday, from Black, Brown, and Beige. Throughout each of its three movements, Ellington explored the range of race relations in the United States, drawing on a musical palette as diverse as its people. Although it was a monumental statement, both musically and socially, the impact of the work fell short. Ellington wasn't as prepared as he should have been, and he had major problems completing the arrangements. Composer and conductor Gunther Schuller.
I happened to be present at one of the last frantic days of rehearsals at the NOLA studio, and I don't know how to put it. I mean, it was pretty chaotic because there was a sense of doom or panic there because I guess they knew by then they weren't going to finish what they had intended to produce. And even though with Billy's help, you know, they just threw various things together, and some of it was thrown together even in the last rehearsal, just with various musicians saying, well, let's do this, let's do that, you know. So it was not a pleasant scene.
Duke Ellington.
Oh, that night was a very hectic night because, you know, 47 minutes of music, you know, and then I walked on stage without the music, which, you know, which I forgot my music. I said, well, you know, this is it, man. I mean, you know, no time to be running off looking for music or all that sort of thing. Either you know it or you don't know it, and go on and do it.
Although Black, Brown, and Beige is now hailed as an artistic triumph, at the time, Duke Ellington's ambitious work was met with criticism. Gunther Schuller.
It was pretty severely trounced, especially by a lot of the classical critics, and even by quite a few of the jazz reviewers, and of course also with some justification.
Duke Ellington.
I don't respect criticism because a critic is limited to their own taste, and only the artist knows whether or not he accomplished his what he set out to do, whether he hit his mark or not.
Ellington would not record or perform Black, Brown, and Beige in its entirety ever again. Was discouraged by the criticism of Black, Brown, and Beige, Ellington pressed on with longer compositions, perhaps trying to achieve the status accorded the great European classical composers. Several other important orchestral suites were introduced at Carnegie Hall, including New World A-Comin', the Perfume Suite, the Tonal Group, the Deep South Suite, the Liberian Suite, and the Tattooed Bride. Duke Ellington's The Tattooed Bride from 1948. In the aftermath of World War II, Americans were no longer hitting the dance floors with abandon, and by the 1950s, there were fewer ballrooms for Ellington to play in. But the change only stimulated his move towards longer thematic works. Conductor and historian David Berger.
Ellington's band was a way that Ellington could hear his music, and it was becoming more concert music and just more serious programmatic music. And he is much more experimental and much freer in his association in the music.
The long-playing 33 and a third record, soon to be in wide use, gave Ellington a recording medium for his extended works,
One of these, Such Sweet Thunder, was Ellington and Strayhorn's 12-part tribute to William Shakespeare. Ellington recalls the enormity of the undertaking.
Actually, I mean, one album, we're not going to parallel any, you know, anything of Shakespeare. I mean, what do you need 1,000 writers and 1,000 years to do it, you know, to cover Shakespeare?
Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn's Star-Crossed Lovers from Such Sweet Thunder, with Johnny Hodges on saxophone. John Sanders says Ellington and Strayhorn simply wrote around the clock to fulfill their commitments and develop new works.
They work at hours that were just unbelievable. And the energy, you know, when other people are sleeping, they're up and about, they're working, creating.
Much of their composing was done long distance, sometimes thousands of miles apart, with Ellington and Strayhorn often finishing each other's work. Jazz impresario George Wien.
He would write music, literally write all night long. Strayhorn would be on a phone in another town, and they would be caught speaking to each other all night. And I was in the room when they did this. I couldn't believe it. There was an alter ego on the other end of the line, and Duke would say, "Well, I got this, you got that first part, I'm doing the middle, you do the last part, see if you can get this feeling, and then we'll pull it all together." And then as soon as he wrote something, he wanted to hear it played.
Duke Ellington.
Old Billy Strayhorn is my writing and arranging companion. And I'll call him and say, "Look, I'm in E-flat or someplace, and the mood is this, and this man is supposed to be walking up the road, and he reaches a certain intersection, and I can't decide whether he should turn left, right, go straight ahead, or make a U-turn." And he says, "Oh, yes, I know what you mean, you know." And... "Well, I think you could do that better than I could." That's his first response, you know. And all the time, he's thinking about how he can outdo me, you know. And very often, without any more than that, we come up with practically the same thing.
This musical empathy allowed them to follow works like Such Sweet Thunder with a premiere of television's first all-black jazz musical, A Drum is a Woman. But to some composers like David Baker, the new extended works were simply a well-chosen grouping of brilliant, shorter works.
I think Ellington found a way to combine pieces that were normally smaller form pieces and to put them into a context that gave them new meanings. In other words, particularly the suites that he wrote. I think they're among some of the most successful ones. For instance, I find something like Sweet Thursday a marvelous work.
Thursday, from Duke Ellington in 1962. There were other masterworks from this period as well,
including Ellington and Strayhorn's arrangements of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite and Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, and the score for Anatomy of a Murder. By the 1960s, Duke Ellington had become jazz's elder statesman. Under the sponsorship of the U.S. State Department, the orchestra toured through the Middle East, India, Africa, and elsewhere. Just as he had absorbed the sounds of Harlem in the 20s and 30s, Ellington now turned these travels into music. Duke Ellington's granddaughter, Mercedes, recalls that Ellington was the ultimate tourist. He took snapshots in music.
You take a vacation, you take your camera. He took his orchestra, and the orchestra, he wanted to reflect the images that he felt and saw in the different countries. So he'd come back and then go into the studio and play the music and write the music. And sometimes he just wrote it and played it right there.
The Far East Suite, one of Ellington and Strayhorn's final collaborations, is regarded by experts as their best work since the early 1940s. It yielded several timeless classics like Ad Lib in Nippon. Live in Nippon, from Duke Ellington's Far East Suite. I'm Nancy Wilson with a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. In 1967, Billy Strayhorn died of cancer. The impact on Ellington was tremendous. He had lost his primary composing and arranging partner. Many of those closest to Ellington believed it was a shock from which he would not soon recover. David Baker.
It must have scared the living bejabbers out of Duke. You know, after his mother had passed away so many years before that, I think that must have hit Duke as hard as anything, because first of all, he loved Strayhorn, but then secondly, because it reminded him again of his own mortality.
Without Strayhorn's help, and with time running down, the pressure on Duke Ellington to compose new music for his orchestra was greater than ever. For the final years of his life, Ellington refined his suites, the ideal form for his growing vision. He introduced several new compositions, including the Latin American Suite, the New Orleans Suite, and the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse.
His final great works were three sacred concerts, inspired by Ellington's ever-deepening interest in the Bible.
All the way down here in the sinful world, no one can help us but you, Lord above. Begging you, Jesus, give me more grace. I need your power to help me to run this race.
Monsignor John Sanders believes that the sacred concerts were a fitting conclusion to Ellington's monumental, and some would say, divine career.
What a magnificent way to close many years of composing. And he did it, as he always did, with musicians in mind, writing for them, directed toward God, you know. And I think he felt very privileged, if I can take the liberty to say that, I think he felt very privileged to have been asked to write sacred music and to bring his orchestra to play it.
Billy Taylor.
Well, in his own words, it helped him to say publicly what he had said on his knees for many years. And Ellington essentially, like many older people, began to think of his mortality and realized that he had a limited time on earth, and he wanted to do things that were lasting. And among the things he wanted to do was to do something that really was to the greater glory of God in his mind. And he felt that God had given him this talent, had given him all of these years of creativity, and he wanted to sort of say, well, thank you very much. This is how I pay back.
Ellington left us a timeless legacy and a unique treasury of classical American music that will never be paralleled. His compositions have had a significant impact on American life and culture, and his influence will be felt for many generations to come. Our look into the genius of Duke Ellington is written and produced for Jazz Profiles by Robert Levy. The executive producer is Tim Owens. The studio producer and mix engineer for this program is John DiLiberto. Associate producer, John McDonald. Assistant producers are Jennifer Raskin and Madeline Smith. We'd like to say thanks to our lead advisor, John Edward Hassey, also Susan Jenkins, Phil Schapp, Patrick Breslin, producer Margaret Howes, and NPR's Making the Music, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Smithsonian's Duke Ellington Archives, and their Jazz Oral History Program, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Special thanks to the New York Foundation for the Arts and to the New York State Council on the Arts for their support. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with Smithsonian Productions, made possible in part by a grant from America's Jazz Heritage, a partnership of the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund and the Smithsonian Institution. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.